content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the August 3rd, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. Cover drawing shows a donkey sitting on the road where the road splits. He's got a halter on, and two people are tugging hard on the halter, trying to get him to go one way. It's Bernie Sanders, and the other person is a young lady named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And the title on the page says, "A Tug to the Left. Is Socialism the Future of the Democratic Party?" We pick up that story when we get to the briefing page, but we'll start as usual with the main stories and how they were covered. A second Putin summit is off. What happened? The White House this week postponed a second meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin as Congress pressed for information about what the two leaders may have agreed to during a private meeting in Helsinki last week. National Security Advisor John Bolton announced that Trump's invitation to Putin to visit the White House this fall had been withdrawn until 2019, after the Russia witch hunt is over. In Moscow, Kremlin foreign policy advisor Yuri Ushakov said that given the current atmosphere in Washington, it would be right to wait for the dust to settle before another bilateral meeting. Many congressional Republicans expressed strong criticism of Trump's submission to Putin in Helsinki and said the Russian leader was not welcome on Capitol Hill. At a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declined to respond to sharp questions as to whether Trump had discussed with Putin lifting sanctions on Russia. Russian officials have touted important verbal agreements made between the two leaders, including the possibility of a referendum in areas of Ukraine held by Russian-backed separatists to determine the region's future. Pompeo said U.S. sanctions on Russia remain completely unchanged and that no commitment has been made to lift them. The Secretary of State pointed to a new formal declaration issued by the State Department that the U.S. refused to recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea and insisted that Trump has a complete and proper understanding that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. What the editorial said: "Is this any way to run U.S. foreign policy?" asked USA Today. "The total lack of transparency around Helsinki has allowed the Kremlin to own the post-summit narrative. Trump met with Putin with only their translators present for some 90 minutes. The result? Russians have been spinning the dickens out of the event while Americans beg for answers from their own government. What we do know is deeply troubling," said the Weekly Standard. At Helsinki, Trump touted an unbelievable offer from Putin that would have enabled Russia to interrogate two men the Russian dictator hates: American-born financier Bill Browder and former U.S. ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul. Browder is an anti-corruption whistleblower who successfully lobbied the U.S. for the Magnitsky Act sanctions against Russia. It took the White House 3 days to unambiguously reject Putin's proposal, which the Senate voted 98-0 to condemn. "Our horror at the president's performance has reached its limit," what the columnist said. "Is Donald Trump even in charge of this government?" asked Paul Waldman of the Washington Post. FBI FBI Director Christopher Wray, U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman, and Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats all publicly distanced themselves from the president's accommodating stance in Helsinki and contradicted Trump's expressed doubts about Russian election interference. We've seen this before. While Trump has personally been a pathetic supplicant to Putin, his administration has pushed ahead with added sanctions and mass expulsions of Russian diplomats, often over Trump's angry objections. This is, to put it mildly, highly unusual. It's also unsustainable, said Susan B. Glasser in NewYorker.com. With Trump at odds with the rest of the Trump administration on Russia and North Korea and Syria, too, we are witnessing nothing less than the breakdown of American foreign policy. The truth is that Helsinki was nothing but an embarrassing spectacle, said Leonid Brzezinski in Bloomberg.com. Given how little support Trump has in his administration and Congress for his Russia detente, any oral agreements he may have made are meaningless. Trump has been reduced to admitting that nothing happened at the summit while simultaneously insisting that it was successful. Russia actually understands American politics better than Trump does, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. Putin resisted a second meeting after Helsinki, knowing it would inflame suspicions he had something on the U.S. president and create a deeper anti-Russia backlash. The Russians feel so fortunate about their big propaganda win at the Helsinki summit that they don't want to jinx themselves by returning to that well so soon. And before we leave this page, let's read one of the It Wasn't All Bad stories. Walter Carr was determined to make a good impression on his first day of work. So when the college student's car broke down the day before he was due to start with moving company bellhops, the Alabamian decided he'd walk the 20 miles to his new job. He set out at midnight and had trekked 14 miles before police stopped him by the side of the road. Amazed by his story, the officers took him to breakfast and gave him a ride the rest of the way. Wowed by his work ethic, bellhop CEO Luke Marklin thanked Carr by gifting him his personal Ford Escape. "I am honestly blown away by him," Marklin says. And our controversy of the week, Trump and Putin, is titled, "Trump and Putin, Bromance or Blackmail?" The allegation that Russia has blackmail evidence of some kind on Donald Trump may have once seemed far-fetched, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. But Trump's strange deference to Russian President Vladimir Putin on grotesque display last week in Helsinki has suddenly moved that possibility to the forefront. Trump has never hidden his admiration for autocrats, of course, and his refusal to scold Putin for Russia's meddling in the 2016 U.S. election probably reflects Trump's own insecurity about his election victory. But still, the sight of a submissive Trump fawning over and practically bowing to a hostile foreign leader was so counter to Trump's brand as a tough-talking America-first nationalist that it calls for a deeper explanation. "I used to doubt that Putin had anything on Trump," said Blake Hounshell in Politico.com. "But after Helsinki, I'm no longer a Russiagate skeptic. Neither his fragile ego nor his autocrat fetish explains why Trump consistently adopts a pro-Putin line and even parrots Russian talking points on NATO, despite great political costs to himself. Unsettling as it is to contemplate, it now seems highly likely that, as the Donald himself might say, there's something going on." The use of compromising material, or kompromat, is pervasive in Russian society, said Adam Davidson in NewYorker.com. Trump has been traveling to Moscow since 1987, including a much-discussed 2013 trip, and even if the American businessman wasn't on Putin's radar before he became president, as Putin coyly claimed last week, Trump's partners and their rivals would have collected kompromat on him for business leverage. The Kremlin may well now have that information, which could be proof of an embarrassing sex act with prostitutes or financial crimes, such as shady loans to Trump's businesses or money laundering. Putin helped Trump win the election, said Julia Yaffe in GQ.com. That's the kompromat. Only Trump's rabid supporters still refuse to accept the documented fact that the Kremlin aggressively interfered to help Trump in an election he won by a razor-thin margin of 77,000 votes over three key states. Putin can puncture that bubble of denial whenever he wants, and Trump knows it. The president's reluctance to admit Russian meddling may be fueling these blackmail rumors, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. But that doesn't mean they're true. More likely, Trump thinks that if he gives an inch on Russian meddling, his enemies will use it to attack his legitimacy. That could be a political miscalculation, but it's consistent with Trump's combative approach to life in general, in which you never admit error or cede ground to adversaries. Why are we searching for some Rosetta Stone to explain Trump's fondness for Putin? Said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. Trump openly envies and covets the authoritarian Putin's very strong control over Russia. We know he shares Putin's amoral and cynical vision of world politics, a brutal nationalistic free-for-all in which the most powerful are free to bully the others. Trump has made it clear he hopes to partner with Putin in a strongman alliance based on narrow self-interest, in which democracy, human rights, immigration, and international alliances like NATO and the EU will be thrown in the trash can of history. Is it possible that Putin has dirt on Trump? Of course. But the simplest explanation for why our president has such a soft spot for the kleptocratic Russian autocrat is that they see the world in just the same way. Well, it was a good week for the dairy industry. After the Food and Drug Administration said it would crack down on the use of the word milk to describe almond milk and coconut milk, since milk must be produced by a lactating animal and an almond doesn't lactate. It was a good week for emergency measures after transportation officials in Vienna, where one subway line has no air conditioning, handed out 14,000 free sticks of deodorant to stinky subway commuters sweltering through an ongoing heat wave. And it was a good week for independents after First Lady Melania Trump reportedly infuriated her husband by watching CNN instead of Fox News on Air Force One and in her separate hotel room during trips. Melania will watch any channel she wants, her spokesperson said. But it was a bad week for carpet bagging after Carol Hafner, a congressional candidate in Alaska's Democratic Party, admitted she has never even visited the state. Don't lock me out just because I'm not a homeboy, the New Jersey resident said, adding she feels a kinship for Alaska. It was a bad week for foreign-made handbags, with Ivanka Trump's announcement that she is shutting down her fashion line, which has suffered a consumer boycott and slumping sales. The company cited ethics rules that limited Ivanka's role and the brand's ability to grow both domestically and abroad. And finally, it was a bad week for Living Free after police arrested a totally naked man in a yoga-like pose at a Planet Fitness gym in New Hampshire. Police said Eric Stagno, 34, explained that he believed the gym slogan that it's a judgment-free zone. And before we move on from this page, let's take this boring but important item. Threatened species lose protections. Congressional Republicans are pursuing at least a dozen pieces of legislation designed to weaken the Endangered Species Act. Congress is moving to strip protection for the gray wolf, the sage grouse, the greater prairie chicken, the American burying beetle, and other species, freeing up their habitats for development. The White House has proposed a provision that, for the first time, would allow economic impact to be considered in deciding how to protect plants that are approaching extinction. The administration's proposed rules would also discount the effect of climate change in assessing threats to wildlife. The 45-year-old law has long rankled ranchers and energy companies who complain that the regulations hurt business. As I mentioned earlier, our briefing page article ties in with the cover drawing on this week's issue. The title is Rise of the Democratic Socialists. Socialism was once a dirty word in U.S. politics, but some young progressives say it is the future of the Democratic Party. Is this the socialist moment as the Democratic Party struggles to rise from the ashes of widespread electoral defeat? A growing number of progressives argue that the party can win back the working and middle class only by moving to the left. This movement took its inspiration from the 2016 presidential candidacy of self-described Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders and his full-throated repudiation of Wall Street and the business-friendly centrism of Hillary Clinton. One of Sanders' supporters, 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, stunned the political world last month by winning her New York City district's Democratic primary on a platform of Medicare for all, free public college, the abolition of ICE, and guaranteed work and housing. In a modern, moral, and wealthy society, no person should be too poor to live, Ocasio-Cortez says. Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez has called Ocasio-Cortez and other Democratic Socialist candidates the future of our party. What exactly is democratic socialism? It depends on whom you ask. Sanders has said his brand of socialism differs from Marxism, which calls for government ownership and management of all private industry. He wants the U.S. to adopt the social democracy of Scandinavian countries like Denmark and Norway, where a robust social safety net operates in a regulated free market economy. To pay for a similar safety net in the U.S., including free medical care and college education for all, Sanders would raise more than $1 trillion a year through higher taxes on most individuals and corporations. But the new guard of democratic socialists, organized under the banner of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, would go much further. Ocasio-Cortez, for example, has said she believes capitalism will not always exist in the world. What is the DSA? It's a national political organization that traces its lineage back to Eugene Debs' Socialist Party from the early 20th century. Though still very small, the DSA has grown from 5,000 dues-paying members in 2015 to more than 45,000 members in about 180 local chapters today. DSA's national platform calls for abolishing capitalism, nationalizing the entire healthcare industry, economic planning ending the influence of money in politics, and restructuring gender and cultural relationships to be more equitable. Many of the socialist principles advocated by the DSA already enjoy broad support among millennials who lived through the fallout of the Great Recession, are still struggling with low salaries and piles of college debt, and are cynical about capitalism and the promise of the American dream. A 2016 Gallup poll found 55% of people between 18 and 29 said they had a positive view of socialism. I already considered myself a socialist, says Amy Zachmeyer, now co-chair of the DSA's Houston chapter, but didn't realize there were so many of us until Bernie Sanders kind of made it okay to talk about being a democratic socialist. How popular is the DSA? Four DSA-backed candidates recently won Pennsylvania state legislature primaries, and DSA says 35 of its members hold office in the U.S., but nearly all of them are at the city and county level, and in solidly liberal districts. In 2016, Sanders did mount a serious challenge to Clinton among Democratic voters, but has yet to show he can win over people who do not already define themselves as liberals or progressives. In polls, about 25% of Americans say they are liberal. If Ocasio-Cortez wins the general election in November, there will be just two Democratic socialists in Congress. Sex and the City co-star Cynthia Nixon has embraced the Democratic Socialist label in her gubernatorial primary campaign versus Governor Andrew Cuomo. But a recent poll has her trailing the center-left incumbent by 35 percentage points. In California, a Democratic socialist running for lieutenant governor finished 8th with 4% of the vote. Is socialism the Democrats' future? Thanks partly to Sanders' success, the party probably is headed to the left on such issues as the minimum wage, marijuana legalization, and health care. But most Democrats remain unwilling to embrace the socialist label. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi recently said Ocasio-Cortez's Democratic Socialism may be ascendant in that district, a very liberal swath of Queens and the Bronx, but argued that it wouldn't play in much of the rest of the country. Our districts are very different, she said. Only 20% of Democrats say the party's ideology is not liberal enough, according to a recent economist/YouGov poll. Lainey Erickson Hatowski of the Third Way, a think tank that advocates centrist politics, recently studied persuadable voters who voted for Barack Obama and switched to Donald Trump, and found they take a dim view of progressive ideology, seeing it as anti-business and its proposals as handouts. If the Democratic Socialists were able to take over the Democratic Party, Hatowski says, I think it would become a minority party for the next 10 to 20 years. First column today also deals with the idea of democratic socialism, and it's titled, Don't Dismiss Democratic Socialism. Republicans had better not dismiss the Democratic Socialists as a fringe movement, said John Hart. The Democrats' socialist surge has the potential to reshape not just the party, but American politics for generations to come. Last week, the country's two leading Democratic socialists, Senator Bernie Sanders and New York congressional candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, parachuted into Kansas, the heart of red state America, for political rallies in behalf of progressive congressional candidates. Conservatives who laugh off Ocasio-Cortez and other Democratic socialists should remember how a small band of activists who called themselves the Tea Party became a major factor in national politics, pulling Republicans and the country to the right. We live in an age of movements, not parties, and disgust with incumbents of both parties is widespread, particularly among millennials. Democratic socialists are actually asking important questions about income inequality and poverty, and conservatives must be willing to debate this issue rather than scoff at it. The U.S. is now entering a long-term generational and worldview conflict over the direction of the nation, and the Democratic socialists will be a force to be reckoned with. And a second column from the U.S. is titled, Living for Vacations is a Trap. The trouble with vacations, said Honor Jones, is that they make everything else look bleak by comparison. When summer comes, overworked Americans are always saying, I need to get away. Get away from what? Your life. This tells us how we feel about the 49 or so weeks a year when we're not on vacations, which are often filled with too much work. The average work week is now 47 hours long, and the average worker takes just 17 days of paid vacation per year. That's a lousy balance. If given the choice between a 50-hour work week and 5 weeks of vacation per year, or a 30-hour work week with no vacation, I would give up vacations. I'd rather have a saner existence most of the time instead of the daily drudgery broken up by the fleeting release valve of trips to somewhere else. Besides, vacations rarely live up to expectations, especially when children are involved. Once the trip ends, you have to go home to a life that offers too little freedom, joy, and play. Here's a better idea. Take all the money and enthusiasm you'd put into a vacation and put it into making your life a little bit better. And we'll move from that to an international column about Israel, a battle over identity and democracy. Israel is a Jewish state, said Giulio Miotte in Arutz Shiva. It's an irrefutable fact, yet one that has never been codified into Israeli law. That's why last week the Knesset voted 62-55 to approve a new basic law, a law with constitutional force that can be changed only by a majority of the legislature, that officially defines Israel as the national homeland of the Jewish people. The law, championed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, states that the realization of the right to national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. It adds that a united Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, that Hebrew is the country's official language, and that the state should encourage and promote Jewish settlement. This law is necessary because Palestinians still don't recognize our right to a homeland, and Israeli Arabs are growing in strength. Without a nationality law, the law of return that grants Jews throughout the world the right to immigrate here could be overthrown as discriminatory. Our flag with the Star of David could be challenged as racist, as could the menorah symbol. This law protects all these. The problem isn't what the national law says, but what it omits, said Susan Hattis Roliff in the Jerusalem Post. Specifically, Israeli Arabs, who make up 20% of the population, and whose rights, especially the right to equality, are totally ignored. This law downgrades the Arabic language from an official national language to one with special status. Worse, its fuzzy conflation of the land of Israel and the state of Israel could legalize the expansion of settlements throughout Palestinian territories. No wonder that when the vote was tallied, Arab members of the Knesset ripped up their copies of the law in protest. Israeli Arab lawmaker Ayman Odeh said Israel has passed a law of Jewish supremacy and told us that we will always be second-class citizens. The entire point of the law is racist, said Mordecai Kremitzer in Haaretz. The state doesn't need a constitutional provision to settle Jews. It's been doing that. It only needs it in order to discriminate against non-Jews and segregate them. What's next? Apartment for rent ads that specify Jews only? Jobs for Jews only? This bigoted law will aggravate Israeli Arabs' alienation from the state. But Netanyahu is happy to sow separatism and factionalism between Jews and Arabs to cement the support of hardliners in his base and the ultra-Orthodox parties in his ruling coalition. We have strayed from the values and our noble Declaration of Independence, said Yedida Stern and Yedioth Aronoth. It calls Israel the national home of the Jewish people, but also pledges full equality for all citizens, regardless of religion, race, or gender. Remember, the Torah commands one law, both for you and for the stranger that sojourneth with you. In insisting on our Jewishness, are we rejecting the values of Judaism? Our in-depth article this week, the last word feature, is titled "The Reality of the Good Guy with a Gun." Two armed bystanders stopped an active shooter who opened fire at an Oklahoma City restaurant, said Francis Steed Sellers and Mark Berman. Their story is more complicated than it sounds. One, Carlos Nazario, was sitting on a lakeside bench waiting to play soccer when he heard the staccato popping of gunshots outside Louie's on the Lake, a popular waterfront grill and pub in Oklahoma City. He ran to his car to get his gun and move toward the sounds. Brian Whittle was driving with his wife, heading off for a Memorial Day weekend getaway when he saw a commotion outside Louie's. He thought someone might be drowning, so instead of turning his truck onto the highway, he barreled into the parking lot to offer help. As he jumped out, what he learned stunned him. There was an active shooter just yards away, and wounded victims were holed up in the restaurant's bathroom. Whittle, too, grabbed his gun. In a matter of seconds, the two armed citizens became self-appointed protectors, moving to take up positions around the shooter, drawing their weapons and shouting for him to drop his. Time stretched and warped. There was an exchange of gunfire. The gunman was hit several times and fell. As Nazario and Whittle converged over the man to restrain him, police arrived. Unsure who was who, officers handcuffed all the men and put them on the ground as the shooter bled out into the grass and died. "I was just doing what I was supposed to do," recalled Nazario, a former police officer who said he now works as a security guard, always has his gun in the car, and usually carries it with him. "I just reacted," said Whittle, who has served nearly 20 years in the Oklahoma Air National Guard and works for the Federal Aviation Administration. "There's a guy with a gun. I've got a gun. stop the threat. Though they were loaded into police cars and taken downtown for questioning, they were soon hailed as heroes. They were also called champions of Second Amendment rights, gun-carrying examples of why Oklahoma's Republican governor should not have vetoed a bill 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks earlier that would have eliminated the need for a permit and training to carry a gun in public. In a nation grappling with frequent mass shootings, Second Amendment activists have urged that more people carry guns so that they are prepared, like Nazario and Whittle, to respond to an armed threat. The morning after the May 24th Oklahoma City shooting, the National Rifle Association tweeted that it was just another example of how the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Local police also praised Nazario and Whittle, saying their swift response ended what a police spokesman called a very dangerous situation. But police also noted that armed citizens can complicate volatile situations. The first of 57 uniformed police officers to arrive just a minute after the initial 911 calls and found a complex scene with multiple armed people and no clear sense of what had happened or who was responsible. "We don't want people to be vigilantes," Bo Matthews, a spokesman for the Oklahoma City Police Department, said in a recent interview. "That's why we have police officers." Both men did what they believed was right, but that meant they had killed a man they did not know. Whittle wondered whether he was going to jail. Nazario went over ways that the confrontation could have ended differently, perhaps with his own death. They both marveled that amid the chaos, the result was as intended. The attacker was stopped before he could hurt anyone else. It was about 6:30 p.m. when the shooting began. A man stood outside the main entrance of the restaurant and fired bullets at the facade, hitting a woman and two adolescent girls as they walked toward the glass doors. People inside panicked, rushing two of the wounded into a bathroom. Nazario, 35, said he heard five or six shots before he retrieved his .40-caliber Glock handgun from his car and headed for Louis. He entered on the restaurant's lakeside corner, diagonally opposite the shattered main entrance. Assuming the tactical stance he learned in firearms training, he crossed the room, assuring customers who had taken cover that he was there to help and asking where the gunman was. Whittle, 39, learned about the shooting from Ron Benton, a Louis patron who had slipped out to the parking lot after the shooting began. Benton pointed out the gunman, who was standing on a grassy slope still holding a Ruger pistol. Whittle grabbed his .40-caliber Smith & Wesson handgun from his truck, ran toward the gunman, and took cover among the parked vehicles to the west. Nazario, emerging from the restaurant's shattered entrance, also spotted the 6'5" Benton pointing out the gunman and approached from the south. Both men shouted at the gunman, with Whittle yelling, "Drop your weapon, I will shoot, just drop it." When the man did not respond, Whittle noticed he was wearing protective earmuffs. Whittle took his left hand off his gun and began signaling his command. The man tilted his head, looked sideways, and raised his weapon. Whittle was staring directly down a barrel. "It looked like a cannon," he said. Whittle dove behind an SUV as the man fired. Nazario then fired, and he believes he hit the gunman in the thigh. He saw the man stumble forward, then right himself and raise his gun again. Whittle, now crouched beside the SUV, took aim and fired. Nazario fired four rounds and Whittle seven. The gunman collapsed. As Whittle lurched forward to kick away the shooter's gun and check for other weapons, he heard a shout, "I've got you covered. Clear him." It was the first Whittle and Nazario knew of each other, and both made the snap decision that they were friends, not foes. Whittle dropped his gun. Nazario holstered his. Nazario grabbed the dying man's right arm while Whittle took his left, just as the first police officer arrived, yelling at them both to get down. He doesn't know how many active shooters there were, Nazario said. He could have gotten out of his car and shot me. As police gained control over the scene, Jabari Giles, father of one of the wounded girls, rushed to the scene. Seeing Whittle and Nazario handcuffed on the ground and a bloodied body that he took to be a victim next to them, he exploded. "Which one of you did it?" Giles shouted. "You effing shot my kid, didn't you?" Giles did not have a gun, but police turned theirs on him and briefly handcuffed him before helping him locate his child. One officer broke the news of the gunman's death to Nazario. "I was kind of shaken up," Nazario recalled. "I thought he had made it." Confusion was still rampant inside the restaurant. A waitress didn't know which way to run amid the shattering glass, upturned tables, volleys of gunfire. "We were told there were three shooters," she said. "In all reality, there were three shooters," said Benton, the Louis customer. The FBI examined 160 shootings between 2000 and 2013 and found that most of the violence ended when the assailant stopped shooting, committed suicide, or fled. Unarmed citizens successfully restrained shooters in 21 of these incidents, according to the FBI. Two attacks stopped when off-duty officers shot and killed the attackers. Five ended in much the way the attack at Louis did, when armed civilians, mostly security guards, exchanged fire with the shooters. In November, Stephen Welford, a former NRA instructor, shot a gunman who killed more than two dozen people inside a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, hitting the attacker twice. The shooter fled and later shot himself in the head while under chase. And in June, a pastor and volunteer firefighter who had been through active shooter training killed a carjacker who opened fire inside a Walmart store in Termwater, Washington. But interventions by Good Samaritans also have ended in tragedy. In 2014, husband and wife attackers killed two Las Vegas police officers before going into a nearby Walmart and firing a shot in the air. Joseph Wilcox, 31, a civilian with a handgun and concealed carry permit, pulled his weapon to confront the male shooter, but the man's wife shot Wilcox in the chest, killing him. When Prince George's County Police Detective Ja'Kai Colson responded to a 2016 attack on a police station in his street clothes, another officer mistook him for a threat and fatally shot him. Ronald Serpas, former police chief in New Orleans and Nashville who lived near Tumwater when he was chief of Washington State Patrol, said such situations raise life or death concerns for police. How is the officer going to discern who is the Good Samaritan and who is not? Serpas said. They don't have placards on the front of their shirts that say, "I'm the good guy" or "I'm the bad guy." Three patched bullet holes on an outside wall at Louis show where the gunman, Alexander Tillman, 28, had fired on customers. The restaurant's glass entryway has been repaired. The three people who were shot as they walked in are expected to make full recoveries, though the two girls have undergone several surgeries. Nazario and Whittle had no idea who Tillman was when they killed him. Tillman did not kill anyone, and any sentence he might have faced had he been apprehended certainly would have been less than death. Though Tillman did not have extensive interactions with the police, his behavior had been raising concerns in Oklahoma City. Local news reports before the shooting indicated that Tillman had posted flyers around the city alluding to demons in cloned transsexual bodies, and a local television investigative reporter alerted authorities to Tillman's bizarre online postings. Tillman was licensed to carry a weapon and had been through training that would have included a psychological evaluation. Prosecutors who took 3 weeks to conclude that Whittle and Nazario would not face charges. Authorities determined that the men had been protecting themselves or others when they opened fire on Tillman. Neither Nazario nor Whittle knows who fired the fatal round or rounds. The medical examiner listed the manner of the gunman's death as homicide as a result of multiple gunshot wounds. "It is what it is," Whittle said. "You'd better be damn sure that what you are doing is right, because you'll pay the consequences if you are wrong." An Oklahoman who grew up among family members who taught him how to handle guns, Whittle vigorously defends the right to bear arms. He notes that not everyone takes action in perilous moments, even in a place where many people carry weapons. "Think about all the people that probably had a gun and didn't go to the situation," Whittle said. "I was comfortable enough to just react." Nazario, who also grew up with guns, emphasizes the importance of the numerous firearms training courses he has taken. "Not everybody knows what they are doing," he said. In the weeks since the shooting, he has replayed in his head different endings to the incident. What if instead of retreating to the grassy bank, the gunman had followed his initial shots through the broken glass door into the restaurant? And what if Whittle had followed the gunman inside? "Brian would have entered the front," Nazario said. "I would have entered the back. There they would have been, two good guys with guns face to face. He could have thought I was the shooter," Nazario said, "or vice versa. And if Nazario had asked and Whittle refused to drop his weapon," Nazario said, "I would have had to take action." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And we'll head on over to the Talking Points page and pick up a couple of the articles there. The first is titled, "Obama, A Break in the Silence. Liberals were begging Barack Obama to speak out," said Jelani Cobb in NewYorker.com. And finally, the former president has reminded them what they have lost. In a Johannesburg speech honoring the 100th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's birth, an effortlessly charismatic Obama offered the sharpest possible contrast between himself and his successor, demonstrating the difference between a statesman and a demagogue. The 44th president praised the stabilizing influence of a unified Europe anchored in NATO, denounced climate change denial and blind partisanship, and warned of strongman politicians who lie without shame and undermine every institution or norm that gives democracy meaning. Not once did Obama mention President Trump by name. He didn't need to. The biggest surprise, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com, was Obama's claim that for democracy to function, we need to get inside the reality of people who are different from us, even if they are white and they are male. This was a bit jarring, since Obama exploited identity politics for partisan advantage at every turn. He once urged Latinos to punish their enemies, said Jim Garrity, also in NationalReview.com, and used a pack of lies to sell Obamacare. If partisanship, deception, and an appetite for utopian slogans instead of serious proposals are more popular now than when Obama took office, whose fault is that? You cannot be serious, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Obama weaved universalist themes into his appeal from the moment he debuted on the national stage, urging Americans to overcome their divisions, and gave a host of stirring speeches on race in which he sought to heal that national wound. He governed like a consensus-minded moderate, which is why he left office with a 60% approval rating. Yet Republicans were committed to concocting out of thin air an imaginary Obama as a race-baiting radical. as an advisor to Republicans John McCain in 2008 and Mitt Romney in 2012. I worked to defeat Obama twice, said Max Boot in WashingtonPost.com. But his faults fade into insignificance compared with the crippling defects of his successor, a pathological liar who just blamed our conflict with Russia on U.S. foolishness and stupidity. Obama's speech last week reminded me of a time when reason and morality reigned, and we had a president with whom I could disagree without ever doubting his fitness to lead. Butina, an accused spy's useful idiots. Still don't believe Russia is interfering in U.S. politics? Then explain Maria Butina, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Shortly after President Trump suggested in Helsinki that Russia didn't hack the Democrats in the 2016 presidential election, a 29-year-old Russian national was charged with conspiring to promote the Kremlin's interests by infiltrating conservative circles. Butina charmed Republican activists and National Rifle Association executives as the ostensible head of a Russian gun rights group and entered into a sexual relationship with an influential 56-year-old GOP operative and NRA fundraiser named Paul Erickson. At a town hall in July 2015, she even asked candidate Donald Trump directly about damaging economic sanctions against, quote, my country, Russia. His answer, I know Putin, Trump said. I don't think you'd need the sanctions. The Butina case opens a brand new front in the Trump-Russia investigation, said James Risen in TheIntercept.com. Her handler in the Russian government appears to have been Alexander Torshin, an ally of President Vladimir Putin with links to organized crime. For months now, federal investigators have been looking into whether or not Torshin and the Russian government used the NRA to illegally funnel money to Donald Trump's presidential campaign, which received $30 million from the gun rights group. The Butina arrest brings the Trump-Russia case closer to Russian organized crime and Putin. The NRA spent more than $50 million getting Trump and congressional Republicans elected in 2016, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. If the NRA turns out to be compromised, it would shake conservative politics to its foundation. Don't jump to conclusions about the NRA's role in Butina's scheme, said David French in NationalReview.com. So far, it appears Butina worked to exploit the NRA's connection to the GOP without the gun rights group's knowledge or cooperation. That may be true, said Matt Lewis in TheDailyBeast.com, but conservatives turned out to be easy marks. Butina, who posted come hither pictures of herself posing with semi-automatic weapons, proved irresistible to right-wing bigwigs, who tend to be men of a certain age. They fell all over themselves to welcome her into the fold. During the Cold War, Soviet agents cultivated liberals sympathetic to communism as useful idiots. Today, the authoritarian Putin has decided to run the same play, except on the right. Page, was spying on him justified? Now we know for sure, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. The unverified Steele dossier, paid for by the Clinton campaign, was the driving force behind the FBI's investigation of the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia. The Justice Department finally released last week 412 pages of documents related to the surveillance warrant FISA judges issued to surveil Carter Page, a former Trump campaign advisor suspected of coordinating with the Russian government to influence the 2016 election. Despite heavy redactions, it's now crystal clear that the FBI obtained the warrant using evidence gathered by Christopher Steele, a British ex-spy working for a firm commissioned by Hillary Clinton's campaign. At some point, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com, The FBI realized Steele's dossier was unreliable, yet they continued to swear to the court otherwise. In other words, the Trump-Russia investigation was built on a lie. That's plainly untrue, said Charlie Savage in the New York Times. In February, House Republicans released a memo written for Representative Devin Nunes, accusing the FBI of relying on politically motivated or questionable sources to obtain a warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But as this document dump proves, the FBI began watching Page in 2013 while investigating a Russian spy ring that was recruiting Americans. Page subsequently met with Russian intelligence officers, described himself as an informal advisor to the staff of the Kremlin, and traveled to Moscow. As for the Republicans' claim that the FBI deceived the four Republican-appointed FISA judges about the origin of the Steele dossier, said David Chris in WashingtonPost.com, that's demonstrably false. The FISA application included a full page describing Steele as likely looking for information that could be used to discredit Trump. Remember, a FISA warrant only requires probable cause that surveillance target is an agent of a foreign power. It's undeniably true that Page had extensive contact with Kremlin-connected Russians. Even with a FISA warrant application now public for the first time in history, said Brian Barrett in Wired.com, the process of obtaining warrants to surveil Americans remains an inscrutable mess. Though the heavily redacted documents do not vindicate President Trump, as he and Nunes claim, their complexity and opacity allow them to continue to make bad faith judgments. And we'll finish with a quote from writer Jennifer Finney Boylan, quoted in the New York Times. She says, "Admit when you are wrong. The older you get, the more frequently you'll have the opportunity." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.